Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, December 13th. I'm Ray Graff. AAA estimates more than a third of Americans will be traveling for the holidays this year. Roughly 102 million people will pack up their cars for a holiday trip. If you're part of this group, you better have a good set of wheels underneath you. And here to make sure that that happens is Gordon Fricke. Gordon is the owner and operator of Barber & Fricke in Hoosick Falls, New York. It's a full-service, independent repair, auto body, towing, and used car facility, and he knows cars. If you have a question, call now, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke and your car calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. On the program once again today to answer your automotive maintenance and repair questions is Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive Incorporated in Hoosick Falls, New York. Gordon has been in the automotive repair and service industry for more than 30 years, and he's a hugely popular guest on this program. So while the getting's good, make that call, 800-348-2551 if you have a question, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke, welcome back, sir. Happy holidays.
Thanks, Ray. You too.
Yeah, you know, a little slippery out there today.
You know, I was very surprised. When I left, there was a flurry in the air, and I drove a vehicle in that I'm preparing for sale, so it's on probably tires that are 75% or better worn.
Yeah.
And when I hit 787 in those ramps and all the way here when it was snow on the road, this car was slipping and skidding.
Well, so, we talk time and time again about the importance of good tires.
Yeah, and I'm telling you, it's all about the tires. It really is.
And you would now... If this was Gordon's car, you'd get some all-weathers and pop them on there?
Well, so I like to do some travel in the winter that takes me into the mountains.
Yeah.
So my vehicle has full winter tires on it, and so does my wife's and mother's. And, you know, if you're going to do more than just average travel on almost always good and clear roads,
yeah,
winter tires are definitely the advantage.
Well, and of course, the advantage for your family is you probably put them on for a very reduced rate.
I give them a discount.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you. Gordon Fricke is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. Let's jump on the phones here. Mary in Albany is first. Mary. Hello.
Hello. I have a question about air versus nitrogen in tires. I've gotten conflicting advice.
Yeah.
You can put nitrogen in tires?
Yes.
I didn't know this.
Yeah, yeah. So it started out in racing. Nitrogen is more stable with changes in temperature. So if you put, let's say, 32 pounds of air in your car tire in a shop that's 68 degrees, and then it's 10 below zero that night,
yeah,
those tires are not going to have 32 PSI in them anymore. The pressure is going to go down because of the lower temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, if it gets to be 95 degrees that day, the pressure is going to increase. Nitrogen has a much less of a swing regarding the temperature.
I'll
so they keep the pressure more stable. And there's a claim that nitrogen tends to stay in the tire a little longer because the molecules are a little bit bigger.
Huh.
Because all tires eventually will lose air.
But can you get that?
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, a lot of tire shops and service centers, some of them got involved in nitrogen tire fills. So you supposedly suck out as much of the air as you can, and then you refill it with nitrogen. Of course,
yeah,
you're never going to get all the air out, so it's a mix. And there is a fee for that, of course. And it's not that major of a benefit in the average driving world, but there is some truth behind it, keeping its pressure more stable. So you can do it. I don't think
okay,
it's...
So having said that, does putting nitrogen in the tire have any effect on the tire pressure monitor?
Oh, great question.
Sometimes in the like the fall weather where it's cold at night, warm during the day, my monitor comes on and I have to reset it regularly.
Right.
Would that make a difference if I put nitrogen?
Well, the nitrogen will reduce those pressure variances due to temperature. So, yes, it will keep the light on or keep the light off more of the time because it's fluctuating less by the temperature outside. But as I said earlier, all tires lose air over time. You can't contain air forever. So tires need to be checked and adjusted for pressure way more regularly than happens most of the time.
All right. Well, Mary, thanks for the call. If you put helium in your tires, will you get better gas mileage?
Makes the car lighter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No one ever tried that.
I don't think so.
You wouldn't want to do hydrogen. That would be bad.
Well, it'd be like the Hindenburg on wheels, right?
Get out of the way there, right? All the humanity. Now, if cost wasn't an option, would a solid rubber tire be usable?
Well, solid rubber is used in applications where there's a lot of bad things in junkyards and rock pits and stuff like that. It's on industrial equipment and mining equipment. For cars, they've experimented with airless tires for years and years and years, and they still are. Ride is a problem because they're
too stiff.
Yeah, they're too stiff. Design costs but they have fooled around with airless tires quite a bit.
I would imagine that you could probably approximate a decent ride by loosening up the suspension a bit.
If there was an airless tire that was harsher, they would definitely make adjustments to the suspension to try to offset that for sure. Yeah.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest, and Bob in Schenectady is next. Bob.
Hi. Yes, I have a question about Subarus. I'm in the market for a new SUV, and I'm thinking about buying a Forester. And I'm wondering if you have had any experience with replacing the head gaskets on those. I'm wondering if the new models have solved that problem.
Yeah, it's a very good question because Subaru had somewhat of an epidemic of head gasket leaking, both early on leaking coolant. And the coolant leakage situation seemed to have gotten solved, and then all of a sudden they started leaking oil. So you almost had almost as bad as a scenario all over again. But the engine design has changed. The timing belt engine is over for Subaru. So if you're looking at a new Forester or very, very new, that will be a timing chain, a chain-driven cam. And the gasket material and the design seems to have changed, and I don't see them leaking oil like that anymore. So to answer your question, yes, I think they're beyond that.
Okay, but they have you seen any of the newer ones that have had, 200,000 miles on them?
I don't know about 200, but I've seen some of the chain-driven engines, well into their 100s.
But no problem.
Not really. We've seen a little bit of leakage from the timing covers, but nothing pouring out like they did when they had those head gasket failures.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I think I'd be better off sticking with the RAV4.
what a good choice, because those are highly competitive models. The RAV4 has proven to be an extremely good and durable car. So I can't really shift you in one direction or the other, but it's a good choice either way.
All right, Bob, thanks for the call. Every time I hear those words head gasket, they put a shiver up my spine as the former owner of two North Star engines. And just for my education, tell us what a head gasket does and why it's such an expensive thing for some cars to replace them.
Yeah. The cylinder head gasket goes between the cylinder head and the engine block. So just basic engine anatomy. You've got the pistons and crankshaft and connecting rods below, the cylinder head with its valves and intake and exhaust systems above, and sealing those two components is a tough job because you got high pressure, heat, massive temperature swings.
Mm-hmm.
Start the car up at 30 below zero, and that engine will warm up to 200 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that every day, maybe four times a day. So that gasket is critical to keep those two pieces of the engine together and sealed. If they begin to leak, you can have major problems. They can leak coolant externally, internally, so you're burning it up. They can mix oil with the coolant. Whole bunch of stuff can go wrong.
And what are they usually made out of?
It's a composite of materials, but there is metal. Some of them are all metal now. They're layered gaskets, so they're multi-layered, so various materials together. And there's some material, old-school gasket material in between on the older cars that would resemble, you know, like a thick cardboard, which it really wasn't. But and to answer your question about the cost, the gaskets are relatively inexpensive.
That's what I thought.
It's all the labor involved to change them, to clean it, to prep it. A lot of times you need new head bolts when you put it together. It's a big job.
And some cars, it's easier than in other cars.
Yes, extremely vary. It varies extremely from one engine to the other.
And why do some go and some are fine?
A lot of it has to do with the original design of the engine itself. Yeah. And the choice of gasket material that the manufacturer used.
Yeah, but you would think if, say, let's just say you were Cadillac and you made a fairly high-end car with a nice engine, that you would make one that might not blow.
They had design issues with those engines. It wasn't really the gasket's fault, really.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I blame the gasket. And I blame myself for buying them.
Blame them both, I guess.
Well, all right, let's take a break here. Enough bitterness. 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest, and we'll get back to more of your calls in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest. And two emails, Gordon, and then we will go back to the phones. This one is from Ann in New Marlborough, Mass. Ann writes, looking to replace my 2005 Pontiac Vibe with 270,000 miles on it. Looking at Toyota RAV and Subaru Crosstrek, which, in your opinion, is more reliable and less costly to repair? Dangerous question.
Yeah, well,
you don't really want to give endorsements, but you can give some general information.
Well, the RAV4, as we had a caller earlier, is one of his choices was a RAV4 versus a Forester.
Yep.
I think. And both good cars, both good choices. We see both of them. The RAV4 is larger than the Crosstrek. This last emailer was talking about a Crosstrek,
mm-hmm.
right? So not a apples to apples comparison, because there's kind of two different cars. The RAV's a little bigger, but
okay.
Without me pointing to one of the two, it's a tough choice. But
all right, this one's from Mark. I've been told that my car needs valve adjustment. I have an 05 Honda Accord with a V6 engine. What exactly is valve adjustment, and why do some cars need it while others seemingly do not?
Yeah.
And will a valve adjustment also include replacing the valve cover gasket?
Yeah, answer to the last part is yes, because you have to take the valve covers off to get to the valves to make those adjustments. And Honda held out with non-hydraulic valve lifters way longer than other manufacturers. However, when you read through Honda's requirements, they will tell you to only adjust them if they are making audible ticking sounds.
Mm.
It's a big job. On a V6. A lot of time involved.
All right. That's an 05, so that is... Okay, very good. Well, thank you for that email. Now let's go back to the phones, and we go to Ken in Saratoga. Ken.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 2012 Nissan Sentra with 120,000 miles on it, and I've been having issues with my fob for opening and closing the door now. It's not functioning at all. I replaced the battery, so I've been using the key. It also has keyless ignition, which doesn't function either. Now, when I lock and unlock the door with the key, sometimes if I lock it, I can't get it unlocked. Is that electronic? Is that sticking? I'm baffled what's going on.
Yeah.
I was stuck out in the cold for 10 minutes yesterday trying to get the door open.
Oh, boy.
So, obviously, you have two fobs with the car, and neither is working, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Did they both fail at the same time? You know, in other words, when one broke, did you go to the next one, and it didn't work as well right then and there?
Yes.
The fobs can be tested to make sure they're sending out the frequency, and any shop that has a tire pressure learning tool. A lot of those have a key fob test because it's similar frequencies that are used. So it'd be nice to get those fobs tested to, just to be sure that they are still sending out the correct signal. Because if it's just a fob issue, you get a new fob, introduce it to the car, and you're working again. Other than seeing what's going on with the car, why it won't read those fobs, it's going to require some scan diagnostics. When you use the backup metal key and put it in that lock cylinder in the driver's door, there is a sensor on the other end of that lock, which is telling the vehicle to lock and unlock. So if there's a problem in the auto locking system, you may be wanting to get that checked sooner than later, because you'll never not be able to get in the driver's door, because that's a mechanical connection from the key to that lock cylinder. But the rest of the doors may stop.
But I couldn't, yes.
Yeah. Was it that you couldn't make the key turn to unlock it?
Right.
Okay, physically couldn't turn it.
Hmm.
So spray the door, latch very liberally with some type of a spray, like maybe WD-40. And also you can put the nozzle of the WD-40 in the lock cylinder and really give that a couple of good blasts. Get that lock free and working so you don't get stuck out of the car again. Other than that, it's going to require
right.
some...
I mean,
yeah.
I've been driving for years with a key to unlock and lock and whatever, so the fob to me was an exciting new technological development. For
right,
me, but,
right.
It's kind of a nuisance, you know. It's this car's been doing little things like windows only roll up but not down with the controls on the driver's side and all those other kinds of things. I can live with that stuff.
Yeah,
yeah. I would get...
Being able to get in my car...
I would lube up that latch and do them all while you're at it, because that's a very overlooked maintenance on any car, to get those latches cleaned up and lubed.
Ken, thanks for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Cars Today with Gordon Fricke at Michael in Sparrowbush. Michael.
Hi. About a month ago, I had new brakes and pads and rotors on my rear wheels. And within a week, everything was rusting. And I had to go back to the mechanic for something else. And I pointed this out to him. And he said, well, everything is like that these days. Rusts immediately. Have I been taken, or is that true?
Yeah, well, it is in a sense that a lot of the replacement brake rotors or discs come unpainted or uncoated, where the new car manufacturers generally have them coated with an electrostatic coating or at the very least a rust preventative paint on the surfaces that don't do the braking. That's raw metal, raw steel all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they can rust even overnight very slightly, and once you touch the brakes they clean themselves. But I think the hat of the rotor that you're looking at is the rotors that your shop put on were probably entry-level, non-painted, non-coated. And we try to put painted and coated on everything just for that very reason. It's not that rotor is going to rust apart on you any sooner, but if you have big wheel openings like alloy wheels, you're going to look in there and see that orange rust, and it doesn't look good. If you look at a higher-end car,
it looks awful.
Yeah, if you look at any higher-end cars with big wheels, with big openings, those brake rotors are always coated, so they don't do that. So that's what's happening there. They're uncoated rotors that are on there now, and you can't do much about it.
Was that just a cheaper way of doing things? Or
The painted rotors nowadays really are not much or any more than the non-painted, and a lot of them are switching to that because of that very reason you're speaking of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Michael, thanks for the call. And now we go to Joe in Albany. Joe, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hi, Gordon. I've got a 2017 Chrysler Pacifica, and I've noticed in going from a very low gear, like first gear to second gear, there's a real slamming coming from the rear end. Now, I presume because it's front-wheel drive that the transmission is way up front. So it's not a transmission problem, but I was wondering if it was some kind of drivetrain connection back there or something like that. It's really quite loud. One time, it slammed so hard, I felt the vehicle lurch forward.
Hmm. So this is not all-wheel drive. This is front only in your vehicle, correct?
That's right. Okay. That's correct.
I would be suspicious that the exhaust system's getting banged, you know, getting moved with the pitch of the engine when it shifts hard, and it could be the exhaust system could be hitting something in the back of the car.
Okay.
Because being front drive only, everything is happening on the front wheels. There's no connection to the back of the car.
Other than
the exhaust system runs from the engine to the tail.
I would maybe
concentrate on maybe ride in the far back of the vehicle, have somebody else drive the car and accelerate and simulate that or reproduce that sound. And then just wiggle the exhaust around and maybe you can make that sound occur when the car's not moving by swinging the exhaust around or up and down. But that would be my guess because that's probably the only connection back there that'll occur when you shift.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Thanks, Joe. Gordon Fricke, the guest today on Vox Pop. It's Cars Today. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. Rich in Shokan. Rich.
Hi. I have a 2013 Toyota Prius. This morning, I had the oil changed on it, and my mechanic was not able to take off the filter. He said that the last shop that put it on too tightly, and today's mechanic actually broke the tool that he used to try to take the filter off.
Yeah.
And I understand it's no longer the standard filter that comes in a metal canister, but some sort of a cartridge that has a cap over it.
Yeah.
And I do intend to bring the car back to the place where they put on this other filter too tightly, but it puzzles me what they will have to do to get it off. Do you have any advice?
Yeah. How long has it been since your last oil change? Just curious. You know, is it year?
I would say maybe 6-7 months.
Okay, yeah, so not terribly long. We run into this fairly often, both with cartridge style and spin-on filters. And what makes it a little touchier is a lot of these filter cartridge housings are made out of plastic. So now you're fearful you're going to break it with the car on the lift and the owner waiting. So that's probably what they were concerned with.
That's what he said, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So what I do in a case like that is you're going to have to, somebody's going to have to get a replacement cartridge housing available right then and there because it may break coming off. The engine wants to be at operating temperature. That helps loosen parts. And they may help get that off by using a heat gun and making that housing even hotter than it is to soften it up and get it off of there.
Mm-hmm.
We've had some vehicles where we'd have to go in there with a massive set of channel lock pliers and hold the base of the housing where it bolts to the engine and have another guy crank on the filter so you're not trying to snap the whole housing off the engine.
Right.
But, yeah, you got to get it changed, of course, and care in installing it and lubricating the threads and the seal is important and not over-tightening it, you know?
All right, Rich, good luck. Thanks for the call. Anna in Liberty is on. Hello.
Yes, hi. First of all, I know nothing about cars, okay? Let's put that right out
okay.
there. Okay.
Okay? All right.
No. If you drive over, let's say, you know, a sidewalk, what's that thing on the bottom of the car that you could, like, scrape and, you know, maybe pull out or yank or, you know, fall or something like that? Something in the form of a bracket. It looks like it's about maybe a foot long. And I don't know how far up it goes, but my fear is that it might be holding up something and having driven over the sidewalk and you know, scraped
yeah.
the belly of the car that Yeah.
What kind of car?
Yeah, and then there's another one about inspection, okay? Oh, it's a Rio, and it's about 10, 12 years old.
It's a Rio.
Until I'm in a panic, okay?
What type of car?
What type of car, Anna?
A Rio four-door.
Rio?
I'm not quite, I can't quite understand the brand.
Regal? No. What is that?
No. I wish it was a Regal. That's a whole name. But, R-I-O, it's not a Kia, not one of those.
It's a Rio. Is it, what brand is it? Do you know? Is it Chevy? Is it a Ford?
Oh, God, I know it's got four wheels, five if you count the steering. Okay, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
The only reason I'm asking is because some vehicles have a lot of splash shields and plastic under them. BMWs.
No, it looks like a metal bracket.
Yeah. Metal bracket.
It looks like a metal bracket.
What side of the car did you go over the curb on, or did you go right over it? Over the middle of the car.
Right over it. Yeah.
So under a lot of cars are brackets and braces that go across the floor, and the exhaust system goes through it, and they use that bracket to strengthen the car. Without seeing it or getting an idea of the year, make, and model of the car, I don't know what bracket it is, but you should get a mechanic to look under there because you may have torn some other things up. I've had vehicles go over curbings and 95% destroy brake lines. So you don't want to just keep driving like that with the potential of a line failure. So
does a Kia Rio make sense?
Kia Rio, yes, a Kia Rio. That's a little car made by Kia.
205, yes.
Yes, yeah, it's a Korean car called Kia.
Korean?
Kia Rio, yeah, I got it, yeah.
Wow.
Now, you had a question about inspections as well?
Yes, the inspection. Why is it that no matter how many things you change on it, you know, like seven or eight things show up as, you know, still faulty when you go for your inspection?
You mean?
Okay, the light never goes off.
As far as the check engine light goes?
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of those are called readiness monitors, and some cars, if they're not driven very much, those monitors will not run properly, and you won't pass your inspection because of that, and I think that's what you're talking about.
Yes, and no matter what they've changed everything in it, you know, just about, and is it possible that because one thing is wrong, a whole bunch of other things are going to show up wrong because they're connected, like, veins in a body?
Yes, it is, yes. You can have one component that's not operating properly, and that will prevent the computer from testing three or four others, so yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, Anna, thanks a lot, and good luck. Boy, I appreciate your call. 800-348-2551 is the number, 800-348-2551. That's trouble. You got all those warning bells on your inspection.
Yes.
And maybe it's time to look for another vehicle. But don't drive it over the sidewalk.
Exactly. Be careful where you go.
Exactly. Let's go to Prescott in Clifton Park. Prescott.
Yes, I have a 2010 Jeep Grand Cherokee. And on the dashboard, I have an Icon tire with a TPM indicator on it. And as far as I can tell, that means my tire pressure's low. I have just put in 35 pounds of pressure in all four tires, and the light doesn't go away. The owner's manual says the spare has nothing to do with that light. I decided I'd disconnect the battery and see if indeed that would reset the light. None of these things have worked. What am I doing wrong?
So when you start that vehicle, does that tire light flash for a little bit of the flashing light indicates that there is a problem with the tire pressure monitoring system, not that you necessarily have a low tire. Being a 2010, you may be needing one or more of the sensors that are inside of the wheels, and those have to be tested. Most everybody now has tire pressure monitoring test equipment, because just about every car has it.
Are they expensive to replace?
The there's a nice availability of aftermarket sensors now, and a lot of these are from the original makers. So to give you an average price, you can buy a new sensor now for $60 to $80 retail money. And then the time to change it, of course, is you have to break the tire partially open to change the sensor and then relearn it to the system. So there's electronics involved.
Yeah.
But it needs to be tested. You really can't do it yourself. You've done everything you can to this point.
Okay. Prescott, thanks for the call. Can't you, Jake? I know I'm a
Luddite. Are you going old school on straights?
I know I'm a dinosaur, but can't you just look at the tires? Do you need a monitor to tell you that your tires are low?
You need a gauge, unless they're really soft, because it's hard to visualize the difference of even 5 pounds on a tire. But it was determined after all those rollovers from early sport utilities with too low tire pressure.
Yeah. It'd
be a good idea to help people be alerted to tires losing air or running too soft.
I see.
It is a safety thing.
All right, fine. You know what? All right. Well, whatever. Gordon Fricke is our guest. And while we're at it, can we have windows that go down and up with a hand crank?
Not many. Not very many.
All right, we'll take a break. We'll be back. And while we're at it, I don't need a digital thermostat for the cabin. Just give me an up or down with the red and the blue and, you know.
How about just hot, cold? Didn't the old cars have hot, cold with arrows?
There you go. You see?
Swing it this way, it gets warmer.
You know what I really want, Gordon? See if you can find one for me. It's one of those Flintstone cars. Very low maintenance.
I had one in the shop the other day. The floors were so rusty that you could put your feet through it. Is that what you're talking
about? Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
All right, let's work a deal out later on. This one's from Donna. My husband wants to install a remote starter in my 2017 Toyota Highlander. I love the idea of it. My husband's a trained airplane mechanic, so I have no doubt in his ability to do it, but I've heard horror stories about aftermarket remote starters, and I wonder if it might void any of my Toyota warranty. Not sure if it's a good idea. That's from Donna.
Yeah, wonderful question, because in the early years of remote starters, we took a lot of them out of cars because they had a lot of failures.
In what way? They wouldn't start the car?
They would, they would fail, and then you couldn't start the car.
Oh.
Or they'd go haywire on you, and they would be tied into wrong circuits. And that's an installation issue, but things went wrong as a result of their installation.
Interesting.
So the car makers, they keep a close eye on what's going on in the aftermarket. And if it looks like there's some action out there that they can get in on, they do it. And most vehicles now have the option of a factory auto start system. And it can come that way as a factory option. A lot of them can be added at the dealer. I would look into that.
Okay.
If I were her, I would see what it costs to have a factory system put in.
All right. Thank you for that one, Donna. This one's from Aaron in Greenfield, Mass. My 2001 Honda Odyssey, or 2001 Space Oddity, I call it, lost power steering a few weeks ago. Then last week while driving home, the battery slowly lost power until the vehicle ceased functioning. I thought that the power steering pulley had caused the serpentine belt to fail, but it looks to have been the belt adjacent to that. The timing belt, question mark? Do you have a theory as to what went wrong and the cost of repair? And that's from Aaron in Greenfield, Mass.
Yeah. The timing belt's not visible when you raise the hood. It's undercover, so that wouldn't be affecting what he's talking about.
Okay.
That would make the engine quit and possibly fail.
Right.
There were some power steering issues on those Odysseys of those years, and we saw a fair amount of pump failures. So that could be the whole issue.
Okay, including the battery slowly losing power?
Well, maybe there's an alternator issue too. He didn't say that the belt is off of the pulleys. That, of course, would wipe out both your power steering and your alternator in one shot.
Oh,
so
that's got to be it then, right?
It's very well. If the belt fell off, broke, or shredded, that will knock out both of those systems immediately.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Aaron. The number here is 800-348-2551. Now we go back to the phones. Jeff in Clifton Park. Jeff.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
I drive a 2010 ML350 Mercedes, and this year I put studded tires on the car. Nokian, I can't pronounce them, Hapapolita, I think, 9s. I do this because even though I commute every day from Clifton Park to Albany for work, I also spend an inordinate amount of time up in the Adirondack. So I'm really kind of concerned about how much I should be driving on these tires, what the wear characteristics of these tires are. I do believe that the studs are made of tungsten steel. Do you have any comments on that? I know that there's not a lot of folks around here that use studded tires, and they're not necessarily recommended for just driving around the Capital District.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting topic because extreme mountainous, icy, hard-packed conditions, the studs are a major advantage. So if you're in the mountains a lot and you're going to be driving in potentially any weather that might come your way, they are an advantage. The amount of time you need them is pretty low, relatively speaking, throughout the entire winter, especially if you're commuting and putting a lot of miles on the vehicle. So now you've got all that metal in the tire that hampers your dry road traction pretty drastically.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you experimented with this vehicle when you got these new tires on, but if you get on some roads or giant parking lots, flick the vehicle around and you're going to find that it's a little bit slippery on dry roads. So you got to get used to that. Because
I found that.
Yes.
Yeah, I found that. Yeah.
Braking, turning, the whole deal.
Yes.
That Nokian's is a fantastic product. You know, these guys are in Finland and they deal with a lot of ice and snow. So there's not any major, fear of driving those as long as you're accustomed to how the car handles and operates. You know, they're noisy, which you already are well aware of now.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean,
they also take down they also reduce your mileage by
sure.
at least a couple of miles per gallon.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. They're heavier and you got a lot of little pieces of metal flying around out there.
All right, Jeff. Thanks for the call. Back in the day, we all used those.
Yeah. Well, back in the day, cars had very poor traction, so you needed everything you could get.
Yeah, but they worked. Let's go to Kreta in Gansvoort. You're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Well, I've never owned. First of all, you have to be some sort of a genius to know all this stuff about new cars.
He is.
I can't even. Oh my God. So anyway, my husband last year bought me a brand new Chevy Cruze, and it has the wide wheels with the aluminum alloy, wide tires with aluminum alloy wheels.
Nice.
Yep.
And I do have snow tires that I have put on it, you know, every fall. But the cost of having the tires taken off the rims and put on the other rims and then mounted to the car is pretty pricey.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about getting some new rims just to keep the snow tires on the rims. What I want to know is, do I have to have that the monitoring device for the tire pressure put on those new rims, is it going to mess up the car and the car is going to be worried that I don't have any tires on it at all? Or can you get away without putting them know what I'm saying?
Yep, it's a very good question because we have a lot of vehicles that with winter wheel and tire packages, and some owners opt to put four sensors in the snow wheels so the light is off and the system's working during the months that you're using your winter tires. It's not mandatory currently that you have that system working as far as inspections and stuff like that goes. So if you got four wheels to put your winter tires on, you can opt not to put the sensors in them. The only thing is your tire warning light will be on the whole time. If you're okay with seeing that light, it'll flash when you start the car. And then
meaning the sensor is not working, but there's no sensor.
There's no sensors there. The computer said the sensors are either all broken or they're gone.
Yep.
And the light flashes for some seconds, and the light stays on the whole time that those wheels are going without sensors.
But if you can live with that, you're fine.
Yes, you can do it.
And I can live with that.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Thanks a lot for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke, the guest, Dave in Shelburne Falls, is next. Dave.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. A good friend of mine many years ago bought a Honda Civic VX, like V as in Victor, and he was so impressed with the gas miles. He said he was able to get easily above 50 miles a gallon with this car, that him and his wife went out and bought a new one in 1993. So I had two questions. How is it that Honda was able to get those types of miles per gallon without hybrid? And secondly, why would Honda ever stop making a car like that that is so economical? I was just curious.
Yeah, I remember those. And they also came out with a later model. I think it was an HF for high fuel, I believe. And what they did is they lightened up the car every way possible. Even though it was a somewhat lower-end model, they all had very lightweight alloy wheels. They cut weight everywhere they could. The cars were generally not full of options. I don't think you ever saw sunroofs in them. Smaller engine, so less power. But people that are looking for max fuel economy are not concerned about maximum power. They don't need, you know, a 396 engine producing 400 horsepower. So that's how Honda squeezed that big those big gas mileage numbers out of those cars. And a lot of car makers do and did that, but we just don't see lots of them in the U.S. But they're all over Europe and Asia because they're having to spend $6 to $7 equivalent per gallon of gas. So to them, it's very necessary.
I see.
That answer
so even
question?
Today's hybrids are a heavier vehicle with
yes.
more gadgets and
exactly.
gizmos on them. And
yep. We don't seem okay. to want cars without any options anymore for the most part. And all those options are heavy.
Hmm. Dave, thanks for the call. We go now to Steve in Hartford. Steve, you're on.
Hey, guys. Hope you're doing all right on this nice cold day.
Oh, we're all right, Steve. How are things in Hartford?
They're cold. A little snow coming down.
All right, man. Go ahead.
Just a couple of years ago, I bought a Scion IA. It's a little econo box, but I was just using it as a temporary car before I got my electric, and sold it to my stepson when he went off to college. Unfortunately, he'd previously lost one of the key fobs, and I didn't want him to have just one fob for it, so I went to replace it. This is just a little heads up to your other listeners. Went to the Scion place, and they said, yeah, no problem. It'll be $100 for the fob and then another, whatever, $150 to program it. Huh. All in all, it was going to come to about actually $300 or so.
Yikes.
Which was, I thought, kind of outrageous.
Yeah.
Went online and found out that if you go to a locksmith that does automotive locks, they can go do it too. Went to one of the local locksmiths around here that does that, and instead of spending $300, it cost me about $85. So it's a whole lot of savings if people end up needing to get something like that replaced. That Scion, by the way, in reference to the previous caller, was routinely getting about 55 miles to the gallon mixed.
That's very good. Yeah.
Anyway,
well, that's
have
it.
A great day, guys.
Hey, man, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551, the number. Gordon Fricke is our guest. And let's go over to Chuck in Delmar. Hello, Chuck.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Okay, so I just bought about 5 months ago a plug-in Toyota Prime Prius. And I've been using it a lot around town, so I've been using a lot with the electric and not using the gas at all. And my question is, should I not do normal oil change intervals on this car? Because the engine really isn't working a typical amount. So like if the oil change interval is 7,500 miles, I'm going to go probably before the engine goes 7,500 miles, I might have, you know, 15 or 20,000 miles on the car.
Boy, you're asking the wrong guy, Chuck. Yeah. Go ahead, Gordon.
Well, no. He's got a good point because that engine is turned off a lot.
Yeah.
That's totally true. What year is that vehicle? Is it brand new?
Yeah, 2018.
Yeah. I would be interested to see how the owner's manual explains that, because I'm sure that car...
Well, that's my problem. I haven't been able to find any reference to that in the owner's manual. And I figured I'd go back and check with the dealer, but I haven't had a chance to do that yet.
Yeah, because a lot of cars use a semi-intelligent oil change interval system where it's kind of watching things like starts and stops and warm-ups and... in addition to mileage, in addition to time. So Hondas, for example, have a countdown system in a percent, and they go start out at 100%, and the dealer says you need to get it changed when it hits 15. And
right.
No two cars sometimes hit that same mileage and time at the same at the same interval because of that smart system. And I got to believe that that new Prius plug-in Prime has somewhat of a oil service monitoring system.
Would you trust it completely, Gordon Fricke?
If the car still has a dipstick, which I think it does, because a lot of cars don't,
yeah.
I like to see how nasty the oil is becoming, and then I make a choice. Do I go another 500 or 1,000 miles, or I change it now? You know?
All right. Well, Chuck, good luck with that one. Thank you for the call. And Joyce, who got dropped earlier, is back. Joyce and Troy, you're on.
I have a 2014 Honda Focus. I bought it secondhand. I've just had it about 3 years. When I got it, I thought the mileage was poor, 25 miles to the gallon. It's dropped to 24.8. Am I correct in thinking 25 miles to the gallon is low? And what's the significance of dropping to 24.8? The car has less than 20,000 miles on it. And do I need snow tires for a light car like this?
Okay.
Okay, so the make and model didn't quite make sense to me. It is a Honda
Focus, it says.
Focus.
Here.
Ford makes Focus.
Oh, Ford Focus, yeah?
Yes. Ford makes the Focus.
Okay, so it's a Ford.
I'm sorry, I borrowed Honda.
That's okay.
Someone was talking about Honda.
Nope.
It's a Ford.
Okay.
Yes, yeah, no problem. So fuel economy will change, and it changes throughout the year because of a bunch of reasons. Wintertime, the fuel companies blend their fuel. They winterize their fuel. It's less efficient. So you guess you get worse economy in the winter months. Add cold temperatures, more enrichment, and tires that are a little bit harder to move around in cold weather. You get worse gas mileage in the winter in general. That's a small car. It should get good economy, and your miles are very low. So
25 miles to the gallon seems to me pretty poor.
Yeah, that car I think should do way better than that.
Well, doesn't it depend on where she's driving,
exactly.
though?
Exactly, and then the driving conditions.
I'm 77 years old, and I occasionally go to the shopping center. Mostly, I'm just driving up the road to the grocery store.
Well, there you go. That
it's not seeing a lot of miles or hard use by any stretch.
Right. Well, that's the reason you're not getting the greatest economy, because you're not on a commute. If you hopped in that car today and went to, let's say, Syracuse on the thruway, you would get way better gas mileage because of the type of driving you're doing.
Starting and stopping and everything else.
It's the worst thing for it. And as to your question on snow tires or winter tires, if you are having to drive in all weather conditions, or you know, if you're doing a commute, which you may not be.
No, I don't commute. I'm living here. I'm living. I don't drive the car every day, and I don't commute any distance with it at all.
If you can pick and choose your weather, you could survive with all-season tires as long as you're not caught out in a massive storm.
Right, just don't drive in the bad weather.
Exactly.
Joyce, thank you for calling. Gordon Fricke, we have made it through another program. How about that?
That went fast.
Good job. So I guess we won't see you we'll see you next year?
I think so, yeah.
All right.
This is our Christmas program right now, right?
Well, ho, ho, ho. Thanks for being here. Support comes from Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear, European styling and prescription and non-prescription sunglasses, eye exams by appointment, EYEDENTITY, eyewearalbany.com. Capital Car Share, a car sharing network offering a fleet of eco-friendly vehicles for neighborhood transportation. 24-hour reservations available online, capitalcarshare.org, for donations and information. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings, henyonbakery.com. At Personal Wine Cellar, Glenville, family-owned business since 2011, offering a selection of wines, spirits, and libations, home of the cellar dweller, monthly scotch and bourbon tastings, home delivery available, 518-399-9463. Well, thanks again to Gordon Fricke for being here today and all year long. We'll see him early in 2019, no doubt. Thank you for listening and for the great calls, as always. Zach Malloy has been our engineer. Jim Lavoulis is our producer. Jesse King took the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Oh, boy. Tomorrow on Food Friday, Chef Gail Sokol will be in the studio with holiday baking tips. Right now, stand by for news.